When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 103. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am heading up to Ulverston in Cumbria to talk to farmer Will Case. Will, how are you?
Hi Will, I'm very good, thanks, very good. Doing all right, thanks, sir. Enjoying life.
Good. Any snow up there, or just wintry?
No. We're right down sea level, and you know, we rarely see any snow, thankfully here. I mean, but further in the fells and the high ground, I believe things are a bit white at the moment, so that can stay up there. We'll happily do without that.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about where you live, because it's quite a unique sort of part of the world up there, isn't it?
Yeah, we're way out west. We're very south of the south tip of Cumbria, in the Furness Peninsula. Really, we're sort of on the tip of the Lake District down here, and we farm on the edge of the Leven Estuary, which is kind of the water from Coniston Lake and Lake Windermere sort of comes into this the estuary before it heads off into Morecambe Bay, and we sort of farm on the edge of that. We're right down at sea level. We've sort of quite a low part of the farm. Half the farm is quite wet. It's low lying sea level and with salt marsh as well. And then we've sort of got behind the farm, it's a little bit rougher and hillier sort of thing. But no, we're sort of near Ulverston. It's a lovely part of the world. We're very mild. We're very wet. But no, it's a good place. We tend to grow grass most of the year round. You know, I've often said it's often the tricky thing in this part of the world is utilization, not growing the grass. So no, it's a good place to farm.
Yeah, okay. And you wouldn't be quite in the national park there, would you, or are you?
No, right at the very edge. The national park just kind of, it's a couple of miles away from us, really. But that's got its pluses and minuses. We're happy with where we are.
So. I was going to say that's probably fortunate.
Yeah, I could say that. I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those, isn't it? But yeah. I mean, you know, you do what you do, and you play the cards you dealt. So that's where we are.
Yeah. Okay. I can't not mention this. I've met you a few times now, and you are one of the biggest fellas I've ever met in my life. Yeah.
That's the cow picture, isn't it?
and not just tall. You're like the very definition of the Merle's, an absolute unit. Are your whole family like that?
we're quite a tall family, I was a very lanky youth, but I probably filled out there a bit since then. But my wife tells me, you're just a big person. That's just, you're not tall, you're just a large person. So I don't know, but it's been something that's always, I've always been pretty tall, really. I'm 6 foot nine, and my brother's 6 foot six, and there's quite a lot of the Case family are tall, I don't know whether it's good Cumbrian Viking heritage. I don't know if it's got us all this height. I don't know, it's easy. I'm useful in crowds, changing light bulbs, and you know, in sort of painting ceilings and things. It's where I come into my own.
Yeah, the exact opposite to me.
Yeah, good things in small packages, Will.
Exactly. So, mentioning your family heritage there, have you always been around there? Family always farmed in that area?
Yes, yeah. I mean, we're a proud bit of heritage. We can trace back our family roots in the Furness area for about 400 years. There's been Casey's farming in the Furness Peninsula since the time of the monastery. And there's a nice bit of local history we're proud of. There was a William Case who farmed near a village called Sellagarth, which was in the grounds of the abbey. And this guy William Case was to be evicted from his farm by the head monk, and so the monastery was to evict him. He was awkward. He took them to the Crown Court at Lancaster and overturned the eviction. So William Case stayed on his farm, and there are still Cases farming in the Furness area to this day. And we've done a lot better than the monks, because the abbey's in ruins. Sorry, the monastery's in ruins, and you know, we feel like that's a little victory there for us. So we're quite chuffed with that one. Yeah, it's a nice story.
Definitely. Yeah, got one over on the church.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so, yeah, it's all about stamina. You know.
That's a great story.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you grew up on the family farm then?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, we set off. My dad farmed in partnership with my uncle George. So Uncle George still farms on the edge of Barrow in Furness, Manor Farm. Until the age of 10, we lived sort of on the in Barrow in Furness, in you know, in a sort of regular sort of house in a street and stuff. And so we were sort of reaching a point where. You know, my dad was looking to do more, and my mother's father, John Fazakli, my granddad Fazakli, he was wanting to do less. So we came to the farm at Plumpton here, where on the outskirts of Ulverston, which were, you know, we sort of set off there, and eventually sort of, you know, took over part of the farm in 1990, and then we sort of worked away right up to 2012, when Grandad sort of properly retired, and you know, yeah, it's been home ever since. So no, since the age of 10, I've lived on the farm, and so we've seen both sides. We've seen living in town and seen living in the countryside, and we're very happy here.
Yeah. Okay. So did you always want to be a farmer growing up? When you moved to the farm at age 10, that must have been a big thing for you, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It was a funny one, I suppose, really, because I mean, when you were at school in town at a young age, we always liked to help dad and things, but to be honest, none of our friends in class or anything at school were from farming families. Yeah. So, but it was always, you know, always loved to help dad and always wanted to sort of be involved with the farm. But it was one of those, you were never really sort of ingrained in farming culture, if you like, because you know, you were in town and things, so it was great to move to Plumpton, and then, you know, soon afterwards came Young Farmers, and you know, it was in the countryside, and we were sort of, farming friends, and I don't know, yeah, life changed a bit, really, I suppose, and that was great, you know, and here we are. So.
Yeah, you mentioned Young Farmers. You were quite heavily involved with it, weren't you?
Absolutely love my time in Young Farmers. I think I think so many people have taken so much from Young Farmers. I mean, I can't, you know, it's like you can't enthuse about Young Farmers enough. I mean, it's fabulous. I was club chairman of Lowick Young Farmers about 4 or 5 years, I think, and I was also a county chairman of Cumbria YFC, which I was very proud to do. Mm-hmm. And that was just a wonderful time of life for me. I think all the skills you get from Young Farmers, I mean, you know, we can't say this enough. I mean, what a sort of a place of learning Young Farmers. Yeah. I mean, both socially and just public speaking, you name it, meeting people, just all these wonderful things, stock judging. I mean, you know, playing the sports and it's fantastic. So no, I think that goes, you know, goes without saying, it's one of the best things you can do, I think.
Yeah, it's a huge confidence builder, isn't it? As you mentioned, just public speaking and learning how to work with other people, and yeah, it's just a fantastic thing.
Absolutely. I mean, our boys are just, and so well, our eldest boy Thomas is 10, and he's just just kind of starting to show interest. Or, you know, we were sort of thinking we weren't going to encourage you for another couple of years, perhaps, just, you know, because I think you want to be, you know, want to be a certain age where you can really appreciate it. But, you know, it doesn't seem long since I was in Young Farmers, and now next thing we're sort of, next thing encouraging the next generation, and you're thinking, wow, right?
Yeah. Yes, I know what you mean.
The fun and games that'll be, but fantastic, you know. Can't wait.
Yeah, and mentioning Tom, so you got three boys, haven't you?
Yes, three boys. Thomas, who's 10, and Ben, who's 8, soon to be 9 next week, and we've got Rory, who's 5. So we've got three very willing and able helpers on the farm and such. And yeah, very good lads. So yeah, they're absolutely our world. They are, and no, they're good boys. So
yeah,
so we miss out at times, but yeah,
yeah. And as I said to you before, it's when I talk to people who've got sort of three or four boys. Cause obviously, I've got the four girls. It's like a glimpse into an alternative universe for me. You know, it's just something completely different, but.
Yeah. Oh, I know what you mean. I mean, you know, we're friends with little girls, and we're like, we don't know about this. We've no idea about these things, these dolls and dresses. Our life is like mud and trackers and rugby and fighting and I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, like you say, it's like through the looking glass, isn't it? But
Yeah, well, it's plenty of fighting here, I can assure you. But
I've no doubt about that.
Yeah, maybe a bit more hair pulling than at your place. But anyway,
I should it, I think.
Yeah. So going
you get up, you get outnumbered. I think that's always the thing. You get outnumbered, and then all of a sudden it's upskilled apple cart, I think. And,
yeah,
it's exactly. All downhill from there.
Yeah, okay. So when you left school, did you go straight to work on the farm or go to college?
I left school and I did part time college at Newton Rig. Mm-hmm. That was fantastic, and then I went to college full time for 12 months, and mm-hmm. then. And then I went back part time again, and we saw. Yeah, I was at Newton Rig, sort of part time for like 4 or 5 years. I mean, good times, really. I mean, I possibly didn't make as much use as college life as maybe I should have done, really, because I was always wanting to get home and see what the crack was at home, and you know, you're up and down the motorway, and desperate to sort of find out what was going on at home and things, and I don't know, but really enjoyed my time at college, and I hope, you know, if my boys are interested and want to farm, I hope they make full use of the college experience, because you know, lots of good times and good friends to be made. So no, I enjoyed my time. Newton Rig's a good old place, really.
Definitely. But you also went to New Zealand for a bit in 2003.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That was fantastic. I mean, it was something I'd always fancied doing. I had a couple of friends who did a bit of backpacking and things, and I had some friends who did shearing who I must say, always whenever the shearers will come every year and you'd sort of tales of New Zealand, Australia and these kind of things, it was always something that sort of caught my ear, and I always thought I'd love to do that. A relation of ours, my dad's now my second cousin, Linda, and her husband Steve, were sort of people who farmed in this area some years ago, and then Steve was a Young Farmers Exchangee in New Zealand, and always had a hankering for going back, and so Steve was took it upon himself to sell up at home and move out to New Zealand, and then he came back. He came back to visit on numerous occasions, but he came back. It was about 2001. And Steve was like, well, if you want to, come out and do something and find some farm work we'll sort you out, we'll help you out. So so I took him up on the offer in 2003 and spent 6 months out in New Zealand, and absolutely wonderful time. And I look back now and I think, geez, I mean, I was absolutely winging it, really. I got out there and Steve was like, yeah, better sort somebody. Better sort something out, really. I haven't just been getting on with this. And so I was like, right, okay. So I was there for a couple of weeks, and he rung up one of his pals who then was like, yeah, we'll have him for a bit. So then I went and working somewhere else. And then And then, yeah, then somebody, you know, then the phone would go, yeah. And you'd go somewhere else. And it, I don't know, yeah, it was. I was completely winging it, but at the time I wasn't fazed. It was one of those things. It was a good crack, and yeah. So I had a couple of weeks up in Heath. So Steve and family are up at Hamilton near Hamilton too. I moved up in the Waikato. Fantastic people. We're still in touch now, and we would very much like to be going. His eldest daughter Amy's getting married in March, and we would have loved to have gone over for that, but it's our lambing time, and,
yeah.
It's a bit of a shame with the timing, but it would have been such fun because Amy's been over to visit us a few times, and you know, we'll go over there again sometime, and but great people, you know, but we'll you know, thoroughly enjoy the time in New Zealand and down in Canterbury in Christchurch, and then down to Wanaka right down there, and fantastic Southland, Otago, and just some great stock farms, working on sheep farms, and really loved it and enjoyed it, and then you know, I had a pal of mine came and joined up with me sort of at the end of the 6 months, and we did a bit of touring around New Zealand and did the tourist thing, drank a lot of beer and had a hoot, and then another couple of pals came over and we went to Australia for the World Cup, and we went to watch England against Wales. Sorry, Will, in Brisbane. That was a tremendous night. What a great time! And then England. We watched the finals outside the ground in a bookies because we couldn't get tickets. We were trying to buy tickets from any Tom, Dick, and Harry, and we just couldn't get in the ground there. Yeah. But good times, and a special time to be over there. Really, so fantastic.
Definitely. So when you came back, did you sort of bring any ideas back with you? Is there anything you sort of learned over there that you particularly wanted to do?
Yeah. I was absolutely charged up with one place I was at for a few weeks. We were techno grazing there and much of what a lot of these guys are doing now with electric fences. I was charged up with this and the potential for all this. Probably the wet summers and things and our climate sort of slightly watered down some of my ideas. We were sort of going to be putting lanes in for techno systems and really, between my dad's skepticism and my optimism and my brother's kind of pragmatism, we sort of ended up it's something that we chewed through an awful lot, and we stuck to rotational grazing principles, but I would kind of say it's rotation light. We're not on like daily shifts or anything like that, and lots of electric fences. We have a lot of small fields on this farm, and we're always moving and shifting sheep and cattle and keeping the grass fresh and things. But I don't really subscribe to some of the more I'm not saying extreme systems, but I like to think I learned a lot in New Zealand.
Yeah.
But I also there was some great the quote that absolutely struck me, because I was over there and I was absolutely charged up with New Zealand stuff, and I wanted to take all this thing and bring it home and rock our world, and there was a guy, David, who I was working for, a wonderful man. He said, is your father a fool? And I was there thinking everything we do at home is wrong, you know. He said, well, is your father a fool? I said, no. I said, is your grandfather a fool? I said, no. He said, so your father's not a fool, your grandfather's not a fool. What are you doing that's so wrong? I said, well, this, this, and this. Well, he said, generally, he said, don't you ever think that a system evolves over a number of years, and if things found well at home? I was like, yeah, they are. And he says, well, don't you ever think that the man of the coal face often has the best insight? And I often repeat this one. But and that's not to say things shouldn't ever change. You know, you should always change things and challenge things. But to sort of all of a sudden think that everything you do at home is wrong and everything that someone else is doing is right is the wrong approach. And there's always a balanced, moderate view, which often gets you the best outcome, I always believe anyway, but that was something that fell out of my world, you know. That was a big sobering moment for me, and I'll never forget that, but I don't know, you learn things wherever you go, and if you stop learning, you start going backwards, don't you? So
you do, yeah. Okay, so before we get on to the farm itself, I do just want to mention the kids and your family again, because as we're going to establish, you've got a lot going on the farm, but you've got a young family like me. And I know you try and to get a work-life balance, which isn't always easy as a busy farmer, is it? So is there anything that you particularly try to do to make that work?
Well, I mean, yeah, in our life, we try and have a work-life balance. My wife, Vicky, she has a busy job. She's head of export control at BAE Systems at Barrow, and she's a team of people who works for her, and she has a demanding job Monday to Thursday. And, we probably have a very full life with three children and things. So we have a lot of structure and routine and try and work and live as orderly as we can. It's a difficult one. I mean, you know, we've a very set sort of routine. We try and have a very set routine. I mean, you know, we don't sort of say if it's a wet day, we're gonna not do that work today. I mean, you know, we're gonna save it till it's dry on Saturday. Mm. We'll have work. We'll have waterproof on. We'll just get stuck in with it. Keep going because, you know, we're trying to. I don't know. We try and have this system where. I work one weekend, my dad works the next weekend, and we juggle along. I mean, it doesn't always work out that way, but we try our best to do it. And I don't like trying to preach about this at all. I'm not preaching about it, but you know, we just try our best to be orderly, because it's quite often so easy to be immersed in everything you're doing.
Yeah.
And just roll on and keep doing the same old thing, but not always taking a step away from farming, or just having a day where you're not farming and just, I think more and more people are doing this. I think more and more farmers are sort of saying, like, come on, we need to get out of the yard a bit and do other things and stuff, because it's an all-consuming life, isn't it? And I feel, certainly a more rounded person when I'm sort of doing other things a bit as well. I mean, my wife isn't from a farming background, and she was in Young Farmers, and you know, she was sort of, you know, familiar with farming, but she's, you know, she's a very organized person, and she's like, come on, we got to do non-farming things sometimes and stuff, and just get out of the routine and I don't know. Yeah, we it's like yesterday, I was off yesterday, and we went to the trampolines in Preston, energy at Preston, and we were bouncing on trampolines and you know, just had a daft afternoon doing something like that. And yeah, it's just great fun. Like, you're out the farm, you're doing something different. I don't know how that just quite makes our work-life balance work. We sometimes question whether our work-life balance works, but I don't know whether we're doing anything and better or worse than anybody else, but we just try and make that time for family and just try and get out that routine. Do other stuff, and I like so many people do, you know, it's one of those things, you know, you gotta do other things, don't you?
Yeah. And that must have been a strong trampoline that you were bouncing on.
I mean, I must look like an absolute freak on it. I am quite good. I'm weirdly very good on trampoline. I really enjoy it. I mean, it's like 19 stone man flying around on trampolines, but like it's really good fun.
Yeah,
I'm actually okay on it. Yeah, it's all right. It's a bit of fun.
Yeah. The farm itself, then, you mentioned your father there, and you're trying to work every other weekend. You work in a family partnership with the farm, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, partnership. My brother Simon and my parents, William and Margaret. And we run two farms. We've got Plumpton Cottage Farm here where I live, and Rob's Auto Farm where Simon lives. We're sort of farming about 700 acres between the two farms. At the moment, we've got sort of Plumpton's 450 acres of sort of permanent and improved grassland, with 150 acres of salt marsh and about 50 acres of woodland. And then down at Barrow, we've got sort of 150 acres. There's 100 acres in a ring fence, and there's 50 acres on the seasonal lets down there. And here we've got, sheep and beef cattle and free range hens. And down with Simon, we've got 100 dairy cows, milked by robots. It's a mixed business. It's sort of, we end up spinning plates and jack of all trades and master of none, but, it works okay.
Well, just funnily enough, I've got that written down because I'm a mixed farmer as well, as you know, similar-ish to you. And do you ever feel that phrase, master of all trades, jack of all trades, master of none? I sometimes, because obviously there's some real advantages with mixed farming, isn't there? If some, something's up, something's down, it tends to work itself out. But sometimes, do you ever feel like you wish you had more time to focus on a particular side of the business? Because I do.
Yeah, I must say. I mean, we're kind of, we sort of have our own departments a bit, sort of thing. So I'm not saying jack of all trades, but I mean, I do very little with the dairy cows at all. Mm-hmm. That's Simon's department, really, and he sort of focuses on the cows and the sort of perhaps the machinery side of things here, and then I'm very much hens and sheep and beef cattle, really. Mm-hmm. So you do end up feeling a little. I must say, where I feel like we lack the focus and direct. When the focused dairy producers and things have got their costs down to the final penny. Mm. And I always think, like, you know, we're sort of over four enterprises and how do you apportion those various machinery costs, et cetera. And I never really feel like our costings are as accurate. We're very much back of an envelope kind of costings people. I mean, and I'd like to be that guy that knows to the last bean, and I say we're rather more broad brush than that. And I don't know. You sometimes feel like, oh God, there's too much going on. at the same time, it's good. I mean, we had an egg price drop last week, but mm-hmm. then we had the opportunity to fix into some milk prices mm-hmm. that were higher, because we're on a contract with the Woodcocks at Yew Tree Dairies where we're allowed to hedge and fix milk. You know, we've given an option to he puts offers out there basically probably about four or five times a year or something. Mm-hmm. He'll say, I've got a 28 pence a litre on offer here. You can fix as much or little milk as you want, with that price, and that price will take you through maybe the next 6 or 12 months. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes only a short 3 month contract. It depends on what the market's offering. But if he's got an opportunity to offer a fixed price to the farmers, we can take or leave the price, or usually we'll fix a percentage to each offer.
Yeah.
So we've got a nice spread of risk, and then sort of work away with that. And so our milk price went up, and then our egg price went down in the same week, and it was a bit like, well, you know, a bit sick about the egg price, and then, well, the dairy price went up, and it was a bit like, well, that's right or wrong, but we're back on an even keel, and somehow our mixed systems kind of got us there through it. And it's been so fashionable to tell everybody to focus and be so focused on production and not on production, but focused on individual enterprises and be that dedicated producer when, you know, you're more exposed, aren't you? And it's probably a bit unfashionable, is old fashioned mixed farming, but it works for us. Not everybody works for us.
Mm. Yeah, no, I'm glad you said, you've made me feel a lot better saying that. So when you came back from New Zealand and you were properly full time on the farm again, were you just beef and sheep then?
We were, we were beef and sheep, and we were fattening and buying stores. I mean, my dad's great passion in life is buying store cattle, and we were sort of trading cattle, and I think we got up to about 1,200 ewes at one stage, and we were buying 500 to 800 store lambs or something like that, and we were just flying all over with sheep all over the place, and winter keep taking and stuff, and I don't know. We seem to have an awful lot of livestock on, yet we weren't really making enough profit for like three men's wages, if you like. Simon and I were kind of, I was reaching a point where I was looking to get married, and Simon was not too far behind, and we were both, you know, wanted to buy a house and this sort of thing. And
yeah.
So it kind of focuses your mind a little bit as to what is and isn't paying. So in 2005, we took the plunge into hens, and we were looking for something, and we were, you know, there was various things we looked at, and you know, in our part of the world, tourism is always something, or contracting of all sorts of things. But it was hens. You know, we were interested in farming and production, and that was where our passion lay. And hens seemed to be a nice complement to the business. So we put the first hen shed up in 2005 for 6,000 birds, and the second hen shed up for another 6,000 in 2007. Sorry. So, yeah, that's been the best thing we've done. And it just, you know, changed the business really. And yeah, went from a, you know, from a sort of, yeah, family-run beef and sheep farm to something a bit bigger, which then allowed us to kick on and, you know, progress forward in other areas. So, yeah, it's been good.
So, and that's a free-range system, right?
Yes, free-range system. And I mean, you know, certainly back then when we put the two sheds up, they were kind of pretty much industry standard free-range sheds. And things have moved on again now to the 16,000 bird standard free-range sheds. And, you know, that's, things have moved along a lot in the last 10 years. But, you know, I mean, and the egg job is going through a difficult period at the moment. But, you know, it's been the best thing we've done. And you know, it did change a lot more profitability, which, you know, which allowed us to, because we kind of went on a sort of,
we had a sort of long-term plan, if you like. We kind of wanted to, you know, reach, one that I've always drilled into is that you need to get to a point where you can split the business at some stage, and we had to have sort of a plan and looking towards succession and things, and you know that we sort of had to kind of work out how we're going to do this, and it wasn't easy. Never is on everybody's own situations. It's never easy, and you know, we sort of had to figure out how we're going to do. So we kind of had a, we set off in about, gosh, was it 2010? We set off to build houses. So at Robswater, in Barrow there, we had sort of a small cottage and a couple of sort of buildings, a barn and a stable block sort of thing next to the farm. So we kind of decided we could sort of develop the property sort of thing with a view to putting a really good house on the farmstead and then maybe selling it and putting towards a bigger farm or something like that. So we set off and built a timber frame house and did a lot of it ourselves. So we built a house and moved in there. And then we kind of thought, right, well, we've had a go at that. And I wanted to move to the farmhouse at Plumpton. So we built Mum and Dad a house at Plumpton. That was in 2011. And then we moved in, well, we sort of finished that in 2012, and we moved into the farmhouse in summer 2012. So that kind of got us to where we sort of wanted to be. We wanted to be sort of, you know, living on farm. That was the goal, the sort of immediate short-term goal was to be living on farm and being closer to our workplace, because we both had young families and we found we were constantly, you know, away from home and working, and, you know, we were sort of, yeah, families living in town and we were back at the farm and stuff. And yeah, so, you know, you end up spread out, which was something that was our immediate short-term goal. And that sort of progressed on into what do we, you know, when we, then Simon kind of decided he was a bit more settled in Barrow, and he kind of thought, yeah, I'm thinking this is all right. We need to develop the property. You know, he used to live in the house and his wife was working in Barrow, you know, kids came along, and it was like, well, so what can we do to develop the business? And he's always had an interest in dairy farming. So, in 2015, well, it'd been something that we'd been working away at for a while. We hardly really dare tell anybody, because I think everyone thought we were nuts. So we just kept
Well, 2015 was a tough year for dairy farming, wasn't it?
That was a rotten year. When we got the build completed, and we did a lot of it ourselves. We took a lot of cost out of the job really by doing a lot of it ourselves. We looked at it like, right, we can get some deals on some stuff here, because nobody in the country is going into dairy in this year, and there was people quite happy to sell us things, and we took quite a lot of cost out of the bill by well, we were feeling hard up to hell, so everything we did, we ground out every bean, every deal we did and stuff. So when we got into milk, I think we were 16 pence, I think, was our opening. There was only one dairy company would take our milk, and that was Carl Woodcock, who thankfully, given us that certainty, allowed us to go into milk. And I think the next month we got down to about 14 and a half pence. So it's pretty grim. but at the same time, we had a long-term view of where we wanted to be. And and everything has its ups and downs, and and the mixed business that the hens kind of carried the cows into that season, if you like, and you know, we were sort of, the hens are doing pretty well, and you know, the sheep were doing pretty well, and we did good stock of beef cattle on, and we sold. We sold sort of 60 Solaire suckler cows, and we set off. If we thought if we could swap one Solaire cow into a dairy cow, we've done okay. We pretty much almost got two dairy cows for a Solaire cow and calf. So there was opportunities to go into dairying for less money, and we just had to say, well, we're not making any profit, but the money we've saved, that's our profit, sort of thing. So we'll work away like that, as daft as that, you know, as daft as that sounds, we'll work away like that, and. And yeah, it's been a success, and everybody thought we were mad, and were convinced we'd go out of business in no time, and the dairy price was going to be on its, you know, uppers for a long time. And anyway, it turned around, and you know, it's working well.
Yeah, and it is a robot system that you put in as well.
Yeah, we've two Lely A2 robots. That was another thing. We were looking at kind of new robots and all kinds of things at the start, and then it was very much like, right, we need to remove a lot of costs from this build. So we found two Lely A2 robots that have been well looked after, and we got them. So yeah, it's a good simple system, and everything goes to the Blue Seamen. So it's British Blue Seamen. It's a total flying herd. We buy sort of cows locally through the local mart sales, mainly from sellers that we know, and Simon kind of gets to buy the udder he wants, which is an important thing with the robots, and you know, so just, you know, we're sort of, and that was another discipline we didn't really feel like we were wanted to learn, was breeding dairy heifers, which is an art form in itself. And we kind of thought, right, let's have a lot of good beef calves and leave the breeding side to the experts who are doing such a fantastic job of it, and then we'll sort of work away with what we know, and then not try and learn too many things at once. So that was the idea.
Yeah, okay. So which is, I mean, you mentioned that you have sort of fairly assigned roles, and is it fair to say that your texels are your passion? Is that what?
I mean, sheep farming in general is, yeah, it's probably a passion of mine, and yeah, the texels are certainly. I must say, I think I find it hard to dedicate as much time to them as I perhaps once was able to do. But I love breeding sheep, and I love the top sales and the whole all-consuming nature of it all, and the breeding and seeing how it's you know, how the next crop of lambs are coming on and how they grow and develop, and I love it all, and it's something I absolutely have a passion for, and it's kind of one of those things you probably can never spend enough time at, but yeah. We juggle it with everything else, and it's pretty good.
Yeah. And what about you've mentioned that you've got quite a bit of salt marsh grazing a few times. For people who might not realize, can you just explain what that is and how that impacts?
We've sort of got 150 acres of salt marsh here at Plumpton, and it's a tidal grazing. It's not a very big salt marsh, you know. From a lot of salt marshes will extend to hundreds and hundreds of acres. I mean, it's it's all good. I mean, we sell the lambs to Booth Supermarket, and their range of salt marsh lamb is kind of. It's been something we've been doing now for a number. Oh gosh, how many years now? A lot of years now we've been doing it, it's been a great string to our bow. Premium product and all that, and it's good. I mean, it's probably a leaner type of meat by the very nature of the salt marsh. It's not as good a quality grazing, but it's a darker, leaner meat, and Booth's are very happy with it. It's kind of a point of difference for them, perhaps. You know, a lot of their summer lamb range, their premium range, is salt marsh lamb, and kind of in the winter it's herd weeks, but it's salt marsh lamb there. So we're very proud of that, and it's
yeah.
It's good. I mean, it's a good premium market for our hands, and one we're sort of keen to, you know, cultivate and do as much with it as we can. So yeah, definitely. Very happy with that, really.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about the business and the different enterprises you've got going on. You've got three boys. Your brother Simon's got three children. So, as you've said, you're obviously planning for the long term, aren't you, with all the different things going on? Do you feel like you're in a good place for that with Succession?
Yeah. I mean, we're very mindful. Yeah, we've got Simon's got two daughters and a young son, and we've got six little opinions coming up behind us, you know.
Yeah.
and no doubt there'll be strong opinions. I'm sure they all will be. And we're going to have to accommodate that somehow if that's what they want, you know. Mum and dad I've always drilled into is you got to split the bit, you know, got to work towards getting a position for that. So yeah, I feel we're quite a healthy position for that, and we've just got to be. It's got to be an evolution towards that goal. You know, we've got to sort of get to that place, and I'm not sure how we quite get there, but we're gonna have to sort of further develop Rob's Water Farm, and we may get opportunities to do that, try and make it all work. So not an easy one. There's so many different situations, isn't there? So many different. Succession is something I believe, certainly in a farm sense, a gradual process that everybody's on board with, and that's pretty tough when you're dealing with people's lives as well. It's not always been easy with us, you know. Any change is not always easy, but we're working towards it. We've got our eye on the same prize, if you like, and we're just working our way towards that end goal.
Yeah, it's just it's communication, isn't it? Although that's not always easy either, is it?
It's very difficult, and I think you've got to maybe set short term goals as well as long term goals as well, and just where do you want to be soon? You know, probably as young people, you're always so often, you know, quick to kind of be like, the older generation are wrong in whatever they're thinking. And often, you know, they've got considerations as well and stuff. And I don't know. Yeah. It's so hard to comment upon, you know, everybody has such different ideas on it. But I believe setting goals and trying to get to the same goals and the same thoughts try your best to work as a team, and it's often not always so easy because, you know, some people can't see, you know, don't look too far ahead or don't want to look too far ahead. That's difficult for them. I don't know. Good luck to anybody who's doing it, because it's not always easy, you know.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, yeah, I know you've had a tough 6 months. Your brother's had a tough 6 months, I should say. He's not been very well, has he?
We got some news last summer, it probably tipped our life upside down. Simon's currently got cancer. He's got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which you know, at first we really didn't know what we were in for at all. When he was first, you know, the big C word is mentioned, I mean, it absolutely tipped our lives upside down. Because I was due to be speaking to you on the Sunday, after I found out on the Saturday, and frankly, at the time, I didn't want to speak to anybody. Yeah, it was. So I mean, that all changed everything for, you know. And I must say, for the next for quite some time afterwards, you just weren't. Your head wasn't in the right place for anything much, and you know, you question a lot of things, and you know, so no, it's a difficult time. But Simon's a very strong person, and he sort of you know, approaches things, we all do, in a positive mindset. We've got to be positive, and you know, he's been very well cared for. He's on number 5 out of 6 bouts of chemo that he's going through, and everything's very positive at the moment. It's a long-term thing, you know, but certainly all the signs are very good, and he remains well within himself, and he's good days and bad days, but you know, he's going about it in a positive way, and he said it's like living with a hangover sometimes, and he's had plenty of those, so he knows what he's doing with hangovers. It's fairly rocked our world a bit, but you know, you focus on your family and you think, well, what does come first? I mean, gosh, you know, I mean, you can get all the work done you want, but I mean, you know, yeah, it certainly opens our eyes a bit, and you think, gosh, priorities, you know, what is important to us, and you know, you've got to make the most of everything, haven't you? And you know, it's amazing how many people it affects. You know, the big C is you know, so widespread, and so many people live with it and cope with it, and you know, it affects so many people. So gosh, yeah, I mean, good luck to anybody that's dealing with it, but you know, it's changed a few things, and you know, but you know, we're sort of we seem to be doing okay with it, and he's doing all right and
good.
It doesn't make you question what I think, that's for sure.
Yeah, when something like that happens, as you say, an awful lot of people listening to this will be a familiar tale to them. Is it hard to focus on day to day things, or does being busy as you are help focusing on that kind of stuff?
It sounds a bit daft, but a bit of both. I mean, it is a bit hard to focus, and you often sort of end up a little bit like, you know, I don't know, a little bit heads all over the place, but at times, yeah, you're just busy and you're cracking on, and you're just like, well, let's, you know, let's bury your head down, and I don't know, I really don't know. I felt like it was something that affected me a lot, and Simon seemed to be just kind of, you know, I don't know, Simon was kind of very sort of positive, and he was, very strong with it all, really. And we all just were like, you know, we're just going to have to get on with this, and team effort and all that. It's a funny thing. It really is. I mean, we didn't really say anything to anybody for a long time about it. And it's a funny conversation to have. You know, he's thankfully been, you know, healthy, as much as he could be throughout, and he's certainly, you know, coming out the right end of things. So no, we're very lucky, and it's heck of a thing.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear he's doing well anyway. Yeah. So, Farmer's Guardian, then I'm going to have to ask you about that. You've been writing in there for a while. How did that come about, and does it come easy to you?
Farmer's Guardian came about basically Ben Briggs and I have a mutual appreciation of Twitter and a mutual appreciation of Blackburn Rovers, and so Ben and I would often chat on Twitter, and then, you know, it was the Cowkes family who were writing the diary before me were sort of looking to give over, and then Ben asked me, did I want to give it a go? So we set off with it, and I've quite enjoyed it, really. I mean, I think when you set off at first, it's very difficult, and then the longer you do it, it probably gets a bit easier. But I must say, I was there thinking to myself, am I getting repetitive? Am I getting boring? And then I was talking to somebody about this, and they said, well, we can remember what you wrote last month, so never mind what you wrote last year. So I wouldn't worry about it, to crack on. So, so I was like, right, okay. I mean, no one takes that much notice of it, and it's just a bit of fun.
Yeah.
And you get to occasionally have a little soapbox about one or two things, and it gets a bit of crack going as well. If you're anywhere where you don't know somebody, and there's often somebody might have read it or might have a bit of a comment or a crack about it, and it's good fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess, as an advantage for you, though, you've got, because you've got so many different enterprises and things going on the farm, at least you've got plenty of material, haven't you?
It does help. I mean, there's often something happening, and we try and I've always something going on throughout the year, and I try and write the article with as sort of true a reflection as I can. It's not all good. There's often bad stuff happens, and I don't know. It's just life, isn't it? And it's good fun.
Yeah, and you've just taken on another writing job as well.
Yeah, just a very small job. There's a local paper. It's just one of the local freebie papers kind of thing that goes around our district, and they said they were looking to have like a sort of a farming column. Every other month or something like that, I think, whatever it is. And I wrote my first one the other week, and I quite enjoyed it. It's just a different angle to write from, and then rather than an industry magazine, you're writing to the general public. And I was just kind of wrote it in a sort of slightly diary-ish kind of form, just to sort of say, well, you know, try and enlighten in any small way sort of people are reading into what's going on in the countryside right now. And I sort of, you know, I don't know, often people, you know, drive past these fields, but don't always just think about what goes on. And the busy people, most people lead busy lives, so, you know, why should they? But if it's just a little bit of information to help them kind of appreciate just what is happening, and it just broadens, you know, their horizons a little bit, I think it's time well spent. And I don't think we can do enough of it as an industry at the moment, that's for sure. It's, interesting times, isn't it?
Yeah,
we seem to get a lot of stick at the moment.
Yeah, we do. I mean, you obviously get as frustrated as I do by the anti-farming stories that we see almost on a daily basis now. I mean, you obviously deal a bit on social media and your newspaper column. That is something we all need to be doing, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? I mean, I don't know. I often find I tweet about things I worry about, and at the moment I'm there, like I see a lot of the anti-farming and the vegan stuff, and it's very worrying, isn't it? It's very negative things, and often you know, it feels, I tweeted the night, it feels like we're under attack.
Yeah.
And I must say, a lot of people say the same thing. I feel like the BBC at the moment seem to be very negative towards farming, and I don't know whether that's just where it's me being paranoid or what, but other farmers say the same thing to me. And Jeremy Vine's show, which I'd always do enjoy, but on Friday afternoon there was a guy from, he was a Oxford University guy who was allowed to speak to sort of further the vegan agenda for possibly about 10 minutes unchallenged, and there was no challenge to him. There wasn't any opposing viewpoint or opposing speaker or anything, and he was just like a pretty much a party political broadcast for the vegan party, you know. And he was, so I just had to, you know, not that they exist, you know what I'm saying? I just despaired it. I was like, my God. But what I often do think is that when you do look down on some of the sort of, you might say, we are often some of the sort of anti-farming tweets or some of the vegan tweets or say there was a little clip of, say, some vegans who were on I don't know, ITV or something, and you're there thinking, gosh, they're talking about how bad farming is, and then actually I always think the sobering part being, and the bit that kind of brings you back to reality that doesn't say isn't so bad, is you read the responses down below, and how I would have said the vast majority is usually supportive of British farming and supportive, and people in general are far more sensible than we often ever given credit for, because we often get caught up in this hyperbole of what's going on, and you know, the media likes to whip things up, and I think the public are sensible, and I think as long as we can, you know, keep giving them good reasons to believe in British farming and British food, I think with a great story to tell, and people are receptive to it, and I do believe people trust farmers, you know, and I think if we keep doing our bit to help them, you know, to educate them and to keep them sort of on our side, I think they'll stand by us as well. I hope so.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more with any of that, really. I think it's just, we've just got to tell our story in a positive way, haven't we? And we've got so many great things going on in farming. We've
absolutely.
It's just putting it out there, isn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, I don't know, I mean, well, exactly like you say, you know, we've a great story to tell, and there is so many positive stories and pictures and just showing the work of farming and you know, I mean, one of our local agricultural societies, Westman Agricultural Society, do an absolutely fabulous job of these farm to fork road shows, and I've been helped out on a couple of those, and we went and pitched up in Barrow and Furness Tesco car park with a cow, some sheep, and a few gazebos and things, and we had a lot of schools came along, and we worked from BE Systems, and just people who were shopping in Tesco in Barrow and things came along. We were talking to people and stuff, and you know, it was quite an eye opener, but most people were very positive, you know, and they were, I mean. There was a few people said, "Oh, how can you eat these? How do you work with the sheep all day and eat them and this sort of thing?" You know, but I was like, "Well, you've got to be a part of things." You know, if you want to see the countryside full of animals and you want to see the environment looking like it does and how well farmed things are and you know, nature and the British countryside being how it is, you've got to be a part of it. And if you don't eat them, they don't exist. You know, and it's just being part of that natural process. And I said, you know, and I do believe some of the offshoots of this current vegan agenda that's going on might be it does increase more, you know, the ethical consumerism perhaps that we're seeing. Maybe that will be an offshoot of it.
Yeah.
Maybe people won't go to entirely plant based diets, but maybe people have a slightly more ethical outlook and look into welfare more. I don't know. Maybe that's just high in the sky, and as soon as it's cheap, we'll go elsewhere. You know, but there's going to be, the answer will be a, you know, won't be as narrow as either of that. It'll be a bit of all of the above. But it was, you know, I was there saying, be a proactive consumer, be an active ethical consumer. I said, choose your most environmentally sound meats or whatever. You want to see sheep free ranging, well, vote with your wallets and buy that fruit, you know, buy those free range eggs, buy those, you know, buy the things you want, you know, and if you will see them if you want them to, you know, exist, you know what I mean? And I think that's important. And we've just got to try and get that sort of message across and not be afraid to sort of talk about what we do and the fact that we eat meat and produce animals, you know, because they're very well looked after and we've got to champion our welfare standards and, you know, not be afraid to shout about it, really.
Definitely, definitely. I was nodding away through everything you just said there. Yeah, no, I agree with everything there. It's we've got to be the ones who tell our own story, haven't we? Otherwise somebody else will.
We tell it best, don't we? We tell it best, you know.
There you go.
Yeah, how we get that across all the time is difficult, but, you know.
Yeah.
We'll just chip away at it.
We'll keep trying. All right, then, Will. Well, the hour's flown by, so I'm going to finish this with the traditional quick quiz with the hard-hitting questions, if you're ready.
All right, good grief. Here we go.
Okay, what's your all-time favourite song?
Right, now I've had a, you know, I'm a bit... There's so many. I love music, and I mean, I've had The Killers, Mr. Brightside written down. I've anything by the Storm Roses, Chemical Brothers, you name it. I've gone for Oasis, Wonderwall.
Yeah, classic. That's classic.
That's a real time of my life, is that? I was of a certain age when that was just the tune for me, and a lot of happy days to that tune. Yeah.
Yeah, it takes you back, that song, doesn't it, to the mid-90s?
Takes me back, yeah. I was into rock music and grunge and things and stuff at school, and then Oasis came along, and they absolutely, just kind of were the right time, the right band for me at the time, and I love Oasis still, and that song's a great anthem, isn't it? Absolutely wonderful.
Did you have long hair in the mid-90s?
No, I didn't, no. I was never that far gone, but
I was going to ask you if I could have a picture.
I love a bit of rock music. Queens of the Stone Age and Nirvana written down a year. Oh dear me, so many good songs. But I was never able. Oh dear me, I'm terrible with that.
All right then. If you weren't a farmer, what would you be?
Another very tricky one. I'd written down a number of things for this as well. Police dog handler. I thought that'd be quite a cool job.
It would be a cool job.
I love my working dogs.
Yeah, I've often thought that. That would be a really cool job.
I, they get to do good things and solve crimes, and you've got your working dogs there and things. I thought, I'd handle that. That'd be okay. And then and building, I quite like building. We're sort of quite happy builders here and stuff like that. And writing's good, and I love the business side of things. I mean, I think as a farmer, you're so lucky to be able to do all of the above. You know, you're working with animals and stock and in the countryside, and but you're doing so many varied things. But I thought, probably police dog handler was something I could live with. So my wife was like, "Are you not being a farmer? That'd be weird." I don't know. We were struggling with that one, but that's the best I can do for you.
All right. If you could go for a pint with anyone from history, who would it be?
This is a difficult one, isn't it? With Margaret Thatcher, I thought that'd be interesting. She'd have a gin and tonic, I think. I'd have a pint. We'd have a natter. That'd be interesting.
It'd be interesting now with everything that's going on.
It would, with everything that's going on now. It's not history, but Richard Branson, what a great beer that would be. Yeah. Have a great crack with him. And Andy McNabb. Another one. This is a personal one, but my granddad Case, I would have loved to see... He took ill when I was very young. He was a very prominent man. He was on boards of things, and he was a great farmer, and he did so much in his time. But I never knew him.
The growing up him,
and I'd love to have a beer with him and find out what he thinks about things. So that's a personal one. So I'm quite a varied answer there, but that's who I'd have a pint with.
Good one. Okay, what's your idea of a perfect Sunday?
Now then, perfect Sunday. So many farmers will say, looking stock and jobs on in the morning. I'm going to say, right, perfect Sunday, I'm having a day off. That's gonna be great. And I'm going to have a lie in and get loads of sleep, and that'll be great. I'm going to take the boys to play rugby. We're going to all watch rugby, and I do a bit of assistant coaching at Ulverston Rugby from the tens, and we'll go and do coaching, and we'll watch my boys play rugby, and that's perfect for me in the morning. Just love a bit of that. And then we'd probably go out for a walk as a family, maybe on the farm, just take the dogs out and have a walk around or something. That'd be grand. Oh, then we'd have roast lamb, salt mash, and at night we'd go to the pub. I have a group of friends, Sunday Night Club we call it, and there's about six or seven of us, and we decided we've been going out for a beer on a Sunday night for nearly about 14 years now.
Wow.
We don't go every Sunday by any stretch, but maybe 3 out of 5. We don't miss too many. And we just meet up for a couple hours in the pub, have a couple of beers, and just now we're a bit older. We're sort of trying to, we meet up to piece together the weekend. Now we're sort of listening about what the young guys have been doing, this sort of thing. So we still do that, which is that's the perfect end to a Sunday for me. So that'll be a good day. Yeah,
good day. Okay, and lastly, then, which farmer or someone involved in the agricultural industry would you recommend to follow on social media, and why?
Now then, right? I've gone for quite a number. I can't pitch up for one, so I've gone for a few.
Yeah.
I'm on Texel Howell Davis, one of the cleverest people I've ever met.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful man, and Peter Vickerton as well. Fantastic guy. A super brain of a man. He's always got a reasonable response and such a great outlook and on life as Pete. And both the guys who we've got to know very well. And Jim Logan as well. Fantastic man. Great farmer and top man. Tom Jones, great guy as well. And, farmers who I greatly admire. Sam Pearson, he's a guy I've never met, but I love Sam Pearson's tweeting. I think he's got a way of tweeting, and I always think he's a fantastic tweeter. And another guy, Joe Stanley. I've never met Joe either, but I love his tweet. I think he does a really good job with his tweeting. I wrote a list of, and there's too many to mention, isn't there? Yourself and JR and all these good people, and there's such a lot of good people. So. That's as slim a list as I could just
Great answers, all of them. All right, then, Will. As we've established over the last hour, you are an incredibly busy guy, so I really do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us tonight, and hopefully we'll see you soon. You have to bring the boys down. Bring the family down.
Well, it's been lovely speaking to you, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And yeah, we'll make a date sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great. All right, then we'll speak to you soon. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and see you next time. If you're feeling generous, please share or retweet this episode on social media. And if you feel like leaving the podcast a review on iTunes, that is a huge help. I'm running the London Marathon for my sins this April for Farm Africa, which is an amazing charity helping farms in East Africa. Have a look at their website for some incredible stories about what they're doing. I'm super proud to be associated with them. If you could spare a few quid, hugely appreciated. I'll put the link in the notes with this podcast. And I thank you in advance. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.